Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Nate Silver, who accurately predicted the winner of 49 of 50 states in the 2008 election. His blog, 538.com, is on the New York Times website, and his articles also appear in the print edition of the New York Times. We will discuss the wildly fluctuating polls as the election enters the home stretch, and his new book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. Then Joan Walsh joins us. She is editor-at-large for Salon.com and an MSNBC political analyst and the author of a new book, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was. We will discuss the gender gap in our politics and what pits Americans against each other as the middle class shrinks, working families struggle, and everyone falls behind except the wealthy. And joining us in the studio is Nate Silver, a statistician, analyst, journalist, and writer. He runs the website 538.com, and his blog, 538.blogs.newyorktimes.com, is on the New York Times website, and his articles also appear in the print edition of the New York Times. He accurately predicted the winner of 49 of 50 states in the 2008 election, and in April of 2009, Time magazine named him one of the world's 100 most influential people. His latest book just out is The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. And it's a pleasure to have you, Nate. You're the man of the moment here because of the closing stretch of the of this long, laborious, and $6 billion
yes.
election. And just your latest piece in the New York Times from Wednesday suggests again that Ohio is not a must-win for Obama, and that the idea that it's always been a must-win state, that's been the conventional wisdom. You point out that actually in 2000, Florida was the must-win.
So it shifts a little bit from election to election, where in 2000 it was Florida. In 2008, the states that would have been decisive if the election had been closer, which of course it wasn't, were Colorado and Iowa, were closest to the national average. But this year it's Ohio with a capital O.
And the math at this point indicates what? That Obama still got an advantage over Romney?
Yeah. So if you look at the national polls, it shows a very close race. Some have Obama ahead, some have Romney ahead. But Obama's maintaining a lead of 2 or 3 points in Ohio, in Wisconsin, in Iowa, in Nevada, and those states would suffice. In fact, he can lose either Iowa or Nevada and still win the Electoral College. So that's how our elections are decided, and those polls have moved since the Denver debate, but they're stuck now, from Romney's point of view, still showing Obama leads in those states.
And of course, if it continues to be close, there is this bizarre scenario of 269 and 269,
yeah.
A tie, and it would seem odd that we have a system. First of all, the Electoral College is an anachronism, but because frankly, out here in California, you don't even know an election's going on.
Well, and I'm in New York, and it's the same thing really. Sometimes you get the commercials beaming in from Connecticut, where they have a competitive Senate race in New York, but there's no sense of an election taking place whatsoever.
Right. So there's no way to not have a tiebreak. I mean, it just happens that way, right? This is where the current Electoral College is.
Well, if you had an odd number instead of an even number of Electoral College votes, then you would avert this potential problem. And you could You could do that by adding another seat to the House of Representatives, for example. But you know, a lot of time in America and elsewhere, we don't deal with the problem until it becomes a crisis, and then we realize,
just like Florida 2000,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
And all those reforms have amounted to nothing.
Well, who knows?
And the Federal Election Commission is moribund.
Well, totally. You know, we have there are a number of states that have signed a compact that says that we will devote our electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote. Of course, you have to have a majority of states do that, right, before it became effective. But maybe if you had Obama win the Electoral College but lose the popular vote this time, which is more likely than the other outcome, then maybe you'd have some Republican states sign on and say, okay, well, we've seen this as an odd way to decide the election, and we know that's hurt us as well as helped us now in the recent past.
Right, but that initiative is actually gaining ground. It's a very simple solution, isn't it, that you just take the popular vote in each state and
So they all commit to it, right? There are some questions about whether it's constitutional proportional or not. But if you had two split outcomes in four elections, I think maybe that would motivate.
Right. Well, we've had some. Two. In 2004, we didn't have it, but it came close. And the Democrats feel that the 2004 election in Ohio was essentially stolen. But had Kerry won had he won Ohio in 2004, he would have been 2.4 million behind in the electoral.
Yeah, so that would have been a
popular vote.
That would have been a big split, a 2-point loss in the national popular vote, 2.5 points, in fact, right. And then him winning the electoral college. So it seems like a lot of it really boils down to the Midwest, frankly, where Democrats have enough strength in the Midwest that region is often decisive, and the other parts of the country can swing in different ways. But there are enough votes there to win or lose the election, particularly for a Democrat when you add up the votes in California and New York and so forth.
So obviously they're concentrating. Both candidates are concentrating on Ohio, and as your latest article in the New York Times points out, that it's really more of a must-win for Romney than there is a way that Obama could lose Ohio and still win, although it's
dicey for Obama, but not impossible. He would have to win any one of Virginia, Colorado, Florida, and those states are about tied. But you know, it's not a disaster for him, right? He'd have to win a state where he's tied now instead of the ones where he's ahead. Whereas conversely, for Romney, if he doesn't win Ohio, he has to win states that look even harder. Wisconsin, for example, is a competitive state, but Romney seems to be down 3 or 4 points in the polls there instead of two. It's a subtle distinction, but at this stage, where every little marginal advantage counts, then that's a harder lift, heavier lift for him. Or Nevada is a state that's started to behave more like a California. It's become more of a blue state. There's a lot of early voting there. Democrats are way ahead. That's not a state you want to have to bank on winning on election night
But Romney is, though. He's putting a lot of effort into it. And you know, you've got the Harry Reid ground game.
Yeah.
And he surprised everybody. And he, in fact, castigated the press in the last election.
That was one that we missed in 2010. We had it going for Engel slightly. But yeah, Nevada's also a state where it's a hard state to poll. The culture in Nevada is a bit different, where it's a very nocturnal kind of culture, not the rhythm that pollsters are used to, where they call you in daytime hours usually. You have a big Hispanic population. There's some evidence, by the way, that polls in California, in Nevada, in Arizona, other states are missing some of these Hispanic voters, and they tend to underestimate the Democratic vote in these West Coast, Southwest states.
Well, obviously, Nate, I want to talk about your new book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. And again, Nate Silvers runs the website 538.com, and his blog is 538.blogs.newyorktimes.com, which is at the New York Times website. His articles also appear in the print edition of the New York Times. You've been running a lot of simulations, 40,000, about the Electoral College, but most of them break Obama's way, right?
That's right. So we have him winning about 70% of the time. And the reason why it's important to run that number of simulations, they only take about, you know, a microsecond each on a computer, is because you want to think about how the states behave in combination with one another. So, for example, if Obama wins Ohio, then it's unlikely that Romney would win Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is a similar state to Ohio, but a little bit more Democratic leaning. So thinking through all those many, many permutations that you might have, it does help to run through all those different potential scenarios. But still, at a very basic level, the state of the election right now is Obama's winning Ohio, not by a lot, but he's ahead by a couple of points there. And if he wins Ohio, he'll probably win the election.
So let's turn to your book, Nate Silver, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. So you're dealing with the world between probability and uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems we have as a culture, as a country, is that there's no consensus anymore about what is true.
Yeah.
Everybody's getting, yeah, you know, the Christians get their news from Christian Broadcasting, the liberals from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox. So you have to start from that premise that nobody even believes what's true. So what is true about what you do? Because you're talking about something that hasn't happened, which is the actual vote.
Well, see, here's the thing is I assert in the book that prediction is a way to test whether we're in touch with reality or not, right? We all have different ideas and theories and hypotheses, right? But if you're right, then you should be able to use that knowledge of the world to predict unknown events. And a lot of times people who are hard partisans are surprised and shocked on election day when the outcome doesn't go the way they want necessarily. With that said, this election's a difficult one to predict, so maybe I'll be one of the failed predictors soon enough. But I am talking, you know, when we issue the forecast, we look at it as a gambler might, for that matter, a weather forecaster, where we say there's a 70% chance of Obama winning, but a 30% chance for Romney, and that 30% chance will come up a lot. It's a very realistic scenario. So that's why I say, you know, I'm not the kind of person who goes up and says, this is definitely going to happen. Those kind of predictions sound great on TV or on the radio, I guess, but they're more prone to failure than the ones that are thought of in terms of uncertainties and probabilities.
So do you try to be governed by humility? Because when you mentioned weather forecast, I mean, yeah, every time we have a slight breeze in California, the weather forecasters go hysterical and talk about hurricanes and storm watch 2012, and they label it all and they get hyped up. So there's so much hype in this world. So is that what you try to govern yourself with?
I try and avoid the hype. And one thing that helps is that I have a program that I designed in 2008 that looks at every poll, and it does so in a way that's consistent, and it has a set of rules for how we evaluate that information instead of doing it in an ad hoc way. I mean, if I follow my Twitter feed or the news feeds I follow, right, every poll touches off some huge discussion and debate about, oh, was the methodology correct? And I'm trying to take more of a macro view, right?
Right.
Who's ahead? Yeah.
But do you have to, when you take that into account, are the polls biased? And as some suggest that, you know, Rasmussen, for example, leans Republican.
There are certainly some polling firms that have a Republican or a Democratic lean or bias. But what we do actually is we take that out. So if you have a polling firm, Rasmussen is one that is not that bad, but a little bit Republican leaning, maybe by a point or two, we just remove that. So if they say Romney's up 3 in a state, we say, well, on neutral terms, it's Romney being up 2 instead. And there are other firms that have a Democratic lean. So we defeat attempts, I guess, to bias the media narrative in that respect.
Again, I'm speaking with Nate Silver of 538.com. He blogs at the New York Times and also appears in the print edition, and is the author of the new book, The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. So just in terms of a reality check, in terms of these turbulent polls that are all over the place and have been since the first debate, did the first debate, was that a game changer?
Oh, sure. I mean, the two most important events of this campaign have been the Democratic convention. I think maybe Bill Clinton's speech at the convention where Obama got about a 4-point bounce, and then the first debate in Denver where Romney got all back then and maybe then some on top of that as well. Those were the
two
things.
How many points would you say he picked up?
So Romney, we think at the peak of his convention bounce, or excuse me, his debate bounce, he had gained about 4 points, bring the race from a 4-point Obama lead roughly to a tie. Now, our model suggests that Obama has regained a point or so since then. He had a strong set of state polls, for example, today. He had some better national polls yesterday. So we think maybe Romney's peak has come and gone, but there's no doubt that there was a trajectory we were on before the debate where it looked like Obama might just kind of run away with this thing, right, and almost win by a 2008-type margin. There was reason to think the polls would tighten, and they did, but it had seemed – I mean, basically, if you look at the candidates who were up by 4 or 5 points in the polls on October 1st, as Obama was, they have a very good track record. They'll win about 80 or 90% of the time historically. And so Romney's odds were pretty daunting, and now they're shorter, although I think people are maybe slow to catch up to the fact that his momentum maybe peaked a week or two ago and he's not still gaining ground. He seems to have flattened out most recently.
So what explains the gap between likely voters and registered voters? Because it seems that Romney's been consistently ahead in likely voters, or at least there are more likely voters on the Republican side, which I imagine means they're more fired up. And I guess the big question here is Democratic turnout, right?
Yeah, so it's enthusiasm plus demographics, where Republican voters tend to be older and wealthier and whiter And all those things tend to correlate with voting at a higher rate, as well as with voting Republican. But there's also an enthusiasm issue. I think Mitt Romney energized a lot of Republicans finally with his performance in Denver. You also have energy from people who just want to get Obama out of office. I'm a little less convinced that Democrats aren't also somewhat fired up, but I think it might depend on kind of a state by state basis. One reason why you might have, for example, Obama doing better in the swing state polls than in the national polls is because they still have a very rich ground game, as we call it, where they knock on a lot of doors and do a lot of targeting of voters and place a lot of phone calls and run a lot of ads. So voters in the swing state might be dragged kicking and screaming to the polls by the campaign, whereas here in California, where I live in New York, you don't have that tug if you're a Democrat.
Right, but don't the Democrats have a lead in registered voters? I mean, it would seem to me that, you know, just as a cursory and trying to be objective about American politics, because I come from Australia where, by the way, you get fined if you don't vote.
Yeah.
And you have a much, much greater turnout. So so in your business, Australia would be easier to work with, I think.
Yeah, because sometimes it's harder to figure out will people vote than who they'll vote for.
Right.
There's little doubt that if every registered voter, not even every adult, just every registered voter turned out, then Obama would win this election. He'd be a 95% favorite.
So you have one party that has an advantage but doesn't necessarily win because it doesn't necessarily inspire its natural base. And then the other party that doesn't have an advantage but is basically always gets every last one of its voters out.
Yeah, this is kind of the yin and yang of American politics, where on the one hand, the Republican coalition is more narrowly drawn, but it's also, if it's more narrow, that also means it's more self-consistent, where Republicans agree with one another on most things, whereas with Democrats, it's more a matter of herding cats and having different interest groups. And so the coalition's larger, that's the reward, but it also means that some members of the coalition might not be as happy about where the party's headed at any given time.
So the curse of identity politics being
that's why basically over the long term each party wins elections half the time, despite the fact that Democrats do have an overall voter registration advantage. It's counterbalanced by the fact that it's easier to get Republicans to move in sequence with one another.
So back to your new book, Nate Silver, The Signal in the Noise: Why So Many Predictions Fail But Some Don't. Now, you're obviously very valuable to a lot of people. There are a lot of groupies out there that live and breathe this election.
And
a lot of my friends are so nervous, they didn't even want to watch these debates. They're so invested in this roller coaster that's going on. But they're obviously, you know, the world of predictions, and again, the world between probability and uncertainty, applies in business, it applies in business forecasting, and it particularly applies in the intelligence world.
Sure.
So how does your work relate, say, for example, to the intelligence world?
So we talk about September 11th in the book, and I interviewed Donald Rumsfeld as well as other experts on national security. And, you know, that's a case where we had different pieces of information that an attack like September 11th was possible, where you had caught Islamic radicals learning how to fly 747s on really flimsy pretenses. You had received warnings about a massive attack from al-Qaeda on the United States. You had detected plots to do similar things to the Eiffel Tower in Paris that were detected early on. So the pieces were there, but we tend to make the mistake of dismissing the unfamiliar for the unlikely. America has not been attacked very much in her history. Pearl Harbor, which still occurred not in the American mainland but in Hawaii, many, many miles away, that was very, very shocking to us. But for that reason, it was, I think, hard for us to contemplate an attack on American soil, and so we maybe didn't really take the threats as seriously as the evidence would demand. And that's a problem in a lot of cases where, you know, the events are kind of considered, I guess, black swans, to use Taleb's term. But really, they're more kind of the exception, more the norm than the exception, really, right? That the collective total of unexpected things, the collective total of improbable things, becomes more likely than you might think. That's kind of how a lot of news is generated, is something unexpected will happen tomorrow and that will grab the headline. But I think sometimes act more surprised than we should, which goes back to maybe not admitting how much uncertainty there really is in the world relative to our ability to understand it.
So how much is then connecting the dots of science, or how subjective is it?
I think our position is inherently subjective in the sense that it's a big, I mean, I believe in objective truth, right? But we are kind of imperfect vessels who only perceive some small part of it. There's so much information, so much data in the world today, we cannot possibly remember or process all of it. So we have to pick and choose what sphere of the world we look at and from what angle we look at it from. And that invariably leads to bias. It's unavoidable. But there are ways to become aware of what your perspective is and to become more objective, I think, and move toward that. But if you start out, I mean, you know, frankly, a lot of the reason why a lot of reporting on the campaign, I think, on the horse race coverage is in my view, quite poor is because reporters don't realize all the different biases that they might have. And I don't necessarily mean liberal bias or conservative bias, but in terms of wanting the race to be a horse race and wanting it to be close and what they mean when they say such and such candidate has momentum or how they frame different things in ways that are not terribly objective. You see around the debates, for example, you had a lot of people saying, well, you know, Romney won the third debate because he tied, right? I mean, that seems like a fairly clear case of bias. But it works the other way at other times, too, during the Libya attacks, right? Instead of the focus on the security failure, which would go to the White House, you had so much focus on Romney's response, right? And both those seemed kind of unweighted from what objective coverage would seek to tell people.
Well, I guess your job is not to follow the pack. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, you know, to the extent you have to pick being a contrarian or a follower, right? Neither one is ideal. You never want to be doing anything predictably, I suppose, but being a little bit of a contrarian is usually helpful. People are less independent-minded than they think they are, and especially in political coverage, there's a lot of kind of a pack mentality, I think.
Well, we've run out of time, Nate. I've enjoyed the conversation. I wish we had more time, but thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nate Silver, who is a statistician, analyst, journalist, and writer. He runs the website 538.com and his blog 538.com/blogs.nytimes.com is on the New York Times website, and his articles also appear in the print edition of the New York Times. He accurately predicted the winner of 49 of 50 states in the 2008 election, and in April of 2009, Time magazine named him one of the world's 100 most influential people. His latest book, just out, is The Signal and the Noise, Why So Many Predictions Fail, But Some Don't. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll come back with MSNBC political analyst Joan Walsh talking about a new book, What's the Matter with White People? Why We Long for a Golden Age That Never Was.
You're like a